Thank you, Carl. Hi, I'm an alcoholic. Thank you guys so much for having me. Carl, I so appreciate being able to be at your group. I want to welcome all the new people to Alcoholics Anonymous. This is such a beautiful Design for Living networks. And I know that I'm in the right place, and I believe all of us are. Just weird days, you know, with the Zoom and everything else. But I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I on June 1st, I celebrated 35 years of sobriety, and I have such a full heart and a grateful heart for that. I spent so much of my life not feeling like I fit in, even with my family or friends that I partied with or coworkers. It didn't matter. I always felt like wherever I was, that wasn't it either. If I was only over there, then I'd be happier. If I had him, or if I had more money, or whatever was going on, and I drink to cover up all those feelings, you know, and that discontent followed me my whole life. And like I said, I'm one of five kids. I grew up back in Ohio, and a lot of alcoholism in my family tree, but I don't blame my alcoholism on my mom, dad, grandparents, or anybody else. It's like the big book says we drink because we like the effect produced by alcohol. And that's how I felt. I sought that escape via the bottle ever since I was a little kid. I would steal alcohol from my parents. My dad, I adored him, and I got to be his helper on a Saturday. And we were down in the basement. I wasn't quite sure what we were doing, but I was the helper. He was drilling a hole in the side of the refrigerator down by the rec room and the pool table and stuff. And what he was putting in was a tap, you know, to put a keg in that spare refrigerator. I love my dad for that. But anyway, so it was easy to help myself to some alcohol. And, you know, when I got in junior high, I really started drinking often. And it was because the neighborhood gang that I ran with, we were good kids. We got good grades and all that stuff. We just, you know, restless, irritable, and discontent. And so there wasn't much going on in this little town in Ohio, but we would find older siblings and people to buy us alcohol, and we would drink and smoke pot and drive around in the country and watch people drag race cars and throw up in the cornfields and, you know, do it some more. You know, it's like, that's as good as it got. But, you know, when I was drinking, I felt comfortable in my skin. I felt like finally I could let the air out and relax a little bit. And it worked. And so I sought that feeling over and over and over again. And, you know, I fought a lot with my mind until I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous and did inventory work that I realized my mom and I were so much alike. And that's why we fought all the time. And it's like, and I didn't care the heartache I caused her, sneak the house, party some more, because I would come home on time occasionally. And then when I didn't, I would sneak back out when I thought she was asleep and go party some more. And I was a good kid. I wasn't sleeping around or anything like that. But you know what? I didn't care that I caused her heartache when she would get up in the middle of the night and one of her five kids wasn't there. And she would just sit up in the living room and she would sit in the dark and drink beer and smoke cigarettes. And when I would come home, I thought I made it, you know, because it was dark. And then I would round the corner to go upstairs and she would take a drag off her cigarette in the dark. And I'm like, oh, I've got two more weeks, I'm grounded. But anyway, just kind of ad infinitum, I was grounded until I left home. And so I didn't care, you know, self-centeredness. I didn't care what kind of heartache or problems I caused. At 18 with a friend from high school, and we were driving to California, and my mom's parents had moved to Tucson. And both my mom and dad grew up in Michigan in a small town outside of Jackson. And my grandparents, after they retired, had moved to Tucson. And so Donna and I stopped to visit them on the way out. And I loved all my grandparents. They were all great people. But that was a side of the family we didn't visit too much because they just drank coffee and smoked cigarettes and talked about God. And it's like, look at the time. I gotta go. It's like, they were nice, but I wanted to drink, you know, and smoke cigarettes. And so we stayed with them for a couple of days. And, you know, I didn't find out until I had 7 years in the program that grandpa had gotten sober in Alcoholics Anonymous in 1947. And I never knew that, but I should have, you know, once I got sober with the coffee, God, and cigarettes. And, you know, my grandpa did, he was a good example of this program because he had a peace about him. He was comfortable in his skin and he was a kind and loving and gentle man. But when I moved to California, Donna went back after a short time. And I started going to school to be a land surveyor, and I was working as a draftsman at an engineering firm. And what little bit of self-esteem I got from my job. I started getting pay raises and promotions, and I was, you know, going to school as often as I could. And my life, my disease wasn't progressing too much at that time. It just was a daily thing. I was a daily drinker and I was a daily puker. I would get up every morning and throw up and swear that I wasn't going to do that again that night. And I really meant it. Every single day I meant it. And it's like, but I would go to work. I'd get there early and make coffee for the surveyors. And most of the time, remember to put the decanter there. But sometimes not so much. The coffee went on the floor. But anyway, I prided myself in my work ethic and that I got a lot done. And so by 10 o'clock, I would eat a cup of noodles and it would calm my stomach down. And by the time I got off work, I thought, you know what? I didn't call in sick again. And I could have every single day and I just a couple. Tonight, I'm just going to have a couple. And I would pick up alcohol on the way home, drink until I blacked out or passed out, whichever came first. And I just kept going and going. And I met this neighbor gal and she was a single mom. I didn't have any kids. I had never been married. And she was, when she didn't have her son, she would come over and we'd drink together and whine about our jobs. And she said, the reason why we were so bored was because we didn't have a hobby and that we needed to go deep sea fishing. And I thought, well, I'll give that a try. And so we went Inside Harbor at it was like 5:30 in the morning on a Saturday to go on open boat, and people were drinking beer on the docks at 5:30. And I thought, oh, I'm a fisherman. I didn't know. We didn't even have fishing poles, you know, but we had coolers of beer. What else do you need if you're going fishing? But anyway, so we had a good time that day, and really we just were partying with the guys on the boat, which was, come to find out, really what we were trolling for. But anyway, so we had a good time out there. And it's funny, for the, I don't know, 25 years of my sobriety, I've chartered fishing boats for coworkers and we go fishing, like for fish. But anyway, it's out there and to be able to do things so, you know, and not have to drink to have fun. I always thought that fun equaled alcohol and getting wasted, and it just isn't true. That was an old idea I had to abandon. And so when I met that one of the guys on that fishing boat, I moved him in shortly after that. And that isn't how I was raised. And it isn't just how I was raised. It was my own beliefs. I don't live like that today. And I didn't before I met him. But I was spending a lot of time sides to my outsides. And I have three sisters and a brother. And they were all back in Ohio. But my three sisters were getting married and having bridal showers and big massive weddings. And then they would buy or build homes out in the country. And then they would buy the Winnebago and all these things and start having kids. And I thought that's why they were happy. They had all those things and him. And so when I was on that fishing boat, it just seemed like, well, there's one, there's a little fixer upper. And so anyway, so I would take, having myself a little project. So I moved him in and it was just chaos. He was an IV drug user, unemployed contractor, found him shooting up in the bathroom. It was insanity. And I became Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And I was just, it was chaos. He wouldn't come home and I would be a crazy person calling all over trying to find him and driving around the middle of the night to the bars and couldn't find him. And It was just chaos. But, you know, that insanity went on for about a year and a half. And then I moved him out for the last time. I did that multiple times, but I kept giving him new keys. Keep coming back. Anyway, so I was like, I thought if he straightened up, I would be happy. That's an Al-Anon thing, but you know, and it was still with those old ideas that somehow if everything around me, or if I had him, or I made enough money or whatever, then I'd be happy. And it's funny, I've had to watch that even in sobriety. It's like, if, you know, lately it's been, you know what, if only I could retire soon, I can retire, then I'll be happy. And it's like, you know, when I know that now, I catch, because I know that that means I'm not living in, and that's where I find God. And that's where I keep that conscious contact with God, is when I stay in the present moment. When I start thinking that my happiness and peace of mind or joy or anything else is just around the corner, down the street, then I know that I'm not working my program. And it's like, you know, I can get back on track, not beat myself up, but it's like, I just know that that's where the intent lies. It's not in my circumstances. It's in my attitude and my relationship with the power greater than myself. So when I moved that guy out for the last time, my drinking progressed even more. He was into other substances, and I had never done anything except smoke pot. In high school, I was, my nickname was Doobie. So I smoked a lot of pot, but anyway, a lot of pot. And so it's like, and so now I see these billboards that they deliver, and I'm like, oh God, those, thank God I'm not partying today. But I managed to find, I needed just fine alcohol or anything else. And so when I moved him out, I'm in my drinking, fast forward. That's what that time with him did, is it fast forward alcoholism. And what happened was my older sister called and said that my mom's alcoholism had gotten so out of hand that she wanted me to fly home to do an intervention, and that her and all my siblings and my dad had been going to Toledo, a treatment center up there, weekly for months to prepare for an intervention. Before I went home, I was to go to one Alcoholics Anonymous meeting and to come home. And for that week, I would stay out in the country at one of their houses. And I would have to drive back and forth to the treatment center and spend all day there every day to and catch up for what they had been doing. And I agreed to do that because I thought, she should get sober. She has a problem. And so I wanted her to straighten up. I didn't want an alcoholic mom anymore. I was done with that. And so so I flew home. And, you know, the only thing I had ever even heard of Alcoholics Anonymous was from my doctor. Because all the time that I had been going to see him with my chronic stomach problems from throwing up all the time, he asked me to drink, and I thought, none of your business was what I thought, but I said a couple. I mean, I didn't see why it mattered. But anyway, he said, oh, okay, well, you might want to cut down. And I'm thinking two. And so anyway, so the second time I went back for more stomach problems, he gave me a prescription for like this Maalox kind of stuff. And then in the office, he had the whole literature rack that you see at meetings with all the pamphlets. And he said, he gave me the prescription and he said, Deb, why don't you look at those pamphlets? And if you'd like any of them, help yourself. And he left the room. And I looked at him and I was thinking, oh, maybe to the woman alcoholic. They had the 20 questions there and too young and whatever. And I was 25. So I was thinking, oh, I'll take a couple of those. And then I realized he's trying to frame. That's what my sharp mind told me, is that there's probably 10 each of all of those. And after I leave, he's going to count them, and then there'll be 9. And those are the ones that I think I am. So I didn't touch a one. And so, because I'm sharp. And so anyway, I left. And so I had heard of Alcoholics Anonymous from him in that brief moment. And so when I went to the Oceanside Lano Club to go to that AA meeting, there was a guy there, Terry. He passed away a couple years ago. But Terry was sponsored by Cliff Roach, and he was a young guy, and he was his secretary, and I had never been to an AA meeting, and I went there. They were all sitting around this in the middle of a room on a Saturday, and it was a book study, and he's, you know, that shared was Fred. He was like, hi, I'm Fred. I'm an alcoholic. Everybody goes, hi, Fred. And I'm chewing my cheek to keep from laughing. I thought, this is so hokey. Hi, Fred. Anyway, so I'm like, so weird. This is perfect for my mother. Anyway, and so after the meeting, Terry called me over and he said, you didn't say you were an alcoholic. And I said, no, I just drink beer only. And you know, that little voice, it's like, you liar, you drink anything, get your hands on. Anyway, I'm listening to my head and then him, and he's smiling at me and I'm sitting on me and I'm thinking, well, maybe he's not bad. Anyway, and so he was thinking chapter three, but what I was thinking he was after me. But anyway, so he took the meeting schedule and he wrote his phone number and name on it and he gave it to me and he said, why don't you call me when you get home from intervention and let me know how it goes. So I took that meeting schedule home with me, and on the bottom of the back of the North San Diego County schedule, it said, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And I thought, what a cool prayer. And I cut it out and I taped it to my refrigerator and I put the meeting schedule in the drawer because I didn't need that. And so I flew home and did this intervention, and I had to go every day to Toledo, and I watched videos on alcoholism. I met with counselors. I had to go to an AA speaker meeting. I had to go to an Al-Anon speaker meeting. I qualified for the day before we were doing intervention, the counselor met with me one-on-one and she said, so what do you think, Deb? And I said, I think I'm an alcoholic. And she goes, you may be, but we're only here for your mom. And I'm like, yes, that's all about mom. Anyway, and so, because she missed that perhaps I might want to give it up. I just realized I was an alcoholic. I had no intention of giving it up. And so we did that intervention, and everybody, it was a really emotional thing that we did, and everybody with their spouses, and my dad and I went home and got mom's clothes and dropped them off to her. She agreed to stay for 28 days, and we went to the Elks Club and drank. We never talked about what just happened. We talked about who I should pick in the football pool, what the weather's like in California, and that was it, just all superficial stuff. We couldn't talk about the feelings at all. I was so shut down because I had just found out that I was an alcoholic, and that was my problem, not the circumstances or the people around me. And I wanted my mom to buck up and get sober. I wanted to get the mom back that I always wanted. And she was funny when she wasn't drinking. She was super funny and she was a good lady. Oh, she was a good lady anyway, but alcoholism kind of won out there. But I didn't care whether I was the kind of wanted. You know, that selfish self-centeredness was that I want what I want and I don't care who I tromp on, I want. And so I came back to California and my drinking obviously kept on going. My mom was an example, a good example to me over the phone. When she got out of there, she was happy playing golf again with my dad. And she was funny and it was just really a good time. And it's like, and then her dad died and she had foot surgery. And after her foot surgery and my grandpa's death, my mom never went back to Alcoholics Anonymous and she went back to drinking. And like I said, I didn't know that my grandpa had been a sober and Alcoholics Anonymous, knew nothing about that. And so that was in November. And then in June, I got sober June 1st. That's when I had a profound spiritual experience. My alcoholism picked up speed yet again. And I admitted on one Saturday morning that I was an alcoholic. And I thought I had to go to a treatment center. She said, you could just go to Alcoholics Anonymous. That worked for me. Sponsored people that have needed and done well with treatment centers, some that did well with outpatient. So me, my path was I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I thank you, God, I haven't left yet. And so I asked God for help. When I came to that morning, a little guest cottage, and it was up this steep driveway, and the landlord's house was in the front, and then you drive around behind it, and above the three-car garage was this little tiny dollhouse with slanted ceilings, and that's where I had lived for 2 months. And so the end of my drinking, I was so paranoid. I thought people were looking in the windows, you know, tall people. Anyway, so I decided the safest place to drink so they couldn't see me was the kitchen floor. And I was so wasted at 26 years old that I'm just hanging on to the drawer handles to try and pull myself up off the floor so I could stagger into the bathroom to throw up. And I fell sideways into the bathtub and couldn't figure out how to get out. And it was just, that's where alcoholism had taken me at 26 years old. And I came to my kitchen table, was in and out of blackouts that night, and I was crying, and I just said, God, help me. And it was a heartfelt prayer, because it was the first time I was sitting at my kitchen table looking out the window, and I had a great view from up on top of that hill. And I saw the connection between me, alcoholism, and all the pitiful and incomprehensible, demoralizing things that I had done when I was out there. It was like it was my whole life was just scrolling in front of me. And when I asked God to help me, it was heartfelt. And I got picked up from under my arms. It was just like that, like getting hoisted out of a chair. I had no idea what had just happened. It felt like somebody picked me up out of my chair. And I went over to the kitchen counter and I watched my hand open the phone book. Conscious thought of what I was doing. I was like, I guess I'm opening and looking for a number. And my hands kept turning the page and my fingers pointed to the Alano Club. And I thought, oh, I know what that is. That's what that Alcoholics Anonymous meeting was. And I just dialed that phone number. And this lady answered, and she was awesome. She was this little tiny petite lady. She was wound up like an 8-day clock. And she goes, hi, I'm Judy. I'm a happy alcoholic. And I'm like, whoa, Judy, like tone it down. You know what I mean? Like she's like, wow. Anyway, and so she was so awesome. And I'm so grateful to her because she said, can you meet right now? She didn't say, by the time you get to this Alano Club, you're going to interrupt this meeting halfway through. She said, come right now. And if she would have said, wait and come tonight at the 8 o'clock meeting so you don't disturb anybody, I don't know that I'd be sober today, because it was that moment of grace where I was willing and I had no conscious thought of, I just did what was in front of me, and it was God's will being done. And so I went, I got in the car and I drove right there, and she was waiting for me at the door, and she just pulled me in. You know, they say in the big book in the back, the beginning of the 12 traditions, it says, to those now in its fold, Alcoholics Anonymous has made the difference between misery and sobriety, and often the difference between life and death. It's like, to those in its fold, they mean in the middle. To those in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's made difference. And it's like, that's what she did for me. She pulled me right into the fold. And that's what hundreds of people since then have done for me, by asking me to share at a meeting, by asking me to be a greeter, by asking me to sponsor them, by asking if I would give them a ride home, by asking if I would fold the phone list, you know, and put them at central office. It's all those kind of commitments are what keep me in the fold, in the middle of alcoholics. And so she brought me right into the meeting, and I didn't remember anything I heard. It's like Charlie Brown's mom, like, mama, mama, you know. The words, they did the Lord's Prayer, and a lady sitting next to me that was knitting offered to be my sponsor. So she sponsored me for a month. I've had multiple sponsors over the years, but she, you know, she served a purpose for those 30 days by getting me to go to 90 meetings in 90 days and to take commitments at meetings and to call her every day. And then it, shortly after, people go, you have Darlene for a sponsor? She doesn't even go to meetings. And so anyway, but she did that day and she got me on the right path, but she ended up going out. But you know what? I just got a different sponsor, and I continued to work my steps. And, you know, they told me that I was as sick as my secrets, and that inventory was something I was really scared about. Let me back up for a second. I knew I was alcoholic and that my life was unmanageable. The unmanageable part I struggled with a little bit, because I still had the old idea that my house was spotless. Everything was clean, because I was like an OCD tweaker, polishing the leaves on my plants and my baseboards and whatever else, you know, when I was drinking. But my visa bill was paid, and I went to work every day, and I got good pay raises and all that kind of stuff. So I thought the unmanageability was that kind of stuff. I'm not homeless. I'm not on the streets. And what I learned, the unmanageability is the inside, the emotion, fears, and the resentments and all that stuff on the inside. I can have a great life on the outside to everybody else looking in, but I knew that I was just, and so I understood that, and I did the third step prayer, and I was so afraid I wasn't going to do it right, you know, like it was some sort of a Billy Graham kind of thing. If you don't do it right, you don't get to make it here. And my sponsor showed me in the 12 and 12 where it says, all you need is the key of willingness, and just open that door ever so slightly. And even though self-will is going to slam it shut again, all you need is that key of willingness again. And I've had times where I've been so God-centered in my sobriety, and other times feel distant from him. But I know it's because I'm not meditating properly. I'm not living in the present moment. I'm not out of myself thinking of others and how can I be of maximum service and all of those things so I can get back on track. But I started in on my inventory. She said, that's what you need to do for step three. And then you launch into a program of action. And you do that inventory and you get rid of the wreckage of your past. And I did that. And the first inventory wasn't great. I did it more like a victim novel. But you know what? It was enough admitting some of the inappropriate behaviors and stealing from the ice cream place I worked at and sexual misconduct and all of those kind of things. Getting rid of that kind of wreckage was enough to start making me feel cleaner on the inside where God could get in, get rid of some of the garbage out and let God in. And I started doing better. And I've done plenty of inventory since then where I know how to do the fourth column, where how did I set the ball rolling and what's my part and that kind of stuff. And so any attempt is a good one, you know, and I'm grateful that you don't have to drink to start over. You can just back it up. And if you're having struggles with a step, I was told to back it up and do the one before again. And you can go all the way back to step one if you need to. But anyway, so I did my inventory, shared it, and then she helped me label my defects. It wasn't that I didn't think I had any. I've never been one of those people that struggled that way. I felt totally defective, but I didn't know how to put the labels to them. So she helped me label them. And then I was to spend that hour of quiet time. And I did that. And I didn't purposely leave anything out. Some things later in my recovery. And I shared those immediately. But I did that inventory. And I did that six and seven step. And made my amends list and started in on that. And I made all my amends, except there's one to that IV drug user's ex-wife who married some man and moved to Pennsylvania. And if and when our paths cross, I'll be able to make amends to her, because I drove her two little boys drunk often and was not a good example of a lady in front of them by my drunken behavior. And one of those young boys died, you know, at a party in his teen years. But I would love to make those amends to her. I've gone on, I try and do 10, 11, and 12 and look at my days and see if I owe people an amends, not just an apology, but a change in my behavior. And I pray, and I've been slacking on the formal meditation again. I did some today, but I don't know why. During this whole COVID thing, you'd think I'd have extra time at home that I would do more formal. And yet I don't know, my whole program and everything is just kind of wonky right now, but commitments, and I Zoom a lot and work with my sponsees over the phone. It's different than at the kitchen table, but it works. And so anyway, by admitting that I'm struggling with meditation, hopefully that will get me more committed back on track. So thanks for bearing with me. And I love sponsoring people and doing 12-step work. I got a 12-step call from Central just a couple weeks ago and was putting together a little meeting at a park with some girls, and we were going to sit 6 feet apart with masks because she didn't want to do a Zoom meeting. She wanted in person, so we were going to make one. And then, you know, she changed her mind, you know, a day and a half later. But you know what? Having the willingness is my job, and the outcome is in God's hands. And so I live my life like that to the best of my ability. And you know, I heard a speaker at my home group, which is the Carlsbad Thursday Night Workshop, and Carl's has spoken there many times, and you'll be speaking there again soon. We got a new secretary this last week. But anyway, I love my home group. I learned a lot there. It's a big speaker meeting, but I was I just lost my place. I just derailed there. Oh, the speaker that I heard early in sobriety, she was talking about how if she would have of everything she wanted in her recovery, she would have shortchanged herself. And I thought, well, then she's not a very good list maker, is she? So I went home that night and I got my pen out and I wrote, I want a husband. I want 6 kids. I want to go to Europe and Alaska. I wanted to pass the LSIT and LS exams to be a licensed land surveyor, finish getting my degree, buy a home. And that was my big list. And I still have that in the first big book that I purchased. And it's like, because what that is now, I've only gotten a couple of things that were on that list in my 35 years of sobriety. But what that list really is, and I found out, you know, as the time went on in recovery, was that was a list of my old ideas of what I thought was going to make me happy, complete, whole, content, and bring me the joy that I sought. Really, all of those things are things on the outside that can come and go. And it's like the promises, I didn't think they were that big a deal. I was like, oh, we're going to comprehend serenity and no peace. Woo-wee. You know, it's like, how about a... Anyway, and so it was like I wanted something a little more tangible than that. But as time's going on, it's like I love the promises. I love the fact that I can be alone and not be lonely, and that I have, I can take all those things that I swore I was never going to tell anybody and share them with other women to make them feel alone and that right place, and that they can stay sober and their lives is going to change for the better. And so I've had a lot of good times in my sobriety, and I did get to go to Europe and Alaska, and it's like I got to speak in Alaska a few years ago, and that was awesome. And I've gone to Europe a couple of times, in New Zealand and Norway, and I've been able to travel sober, you know, and it's like, and go to meetings and have a lot of fun. Before I left for the first place I went was England. And I had about 7 years of sobriety at that time. And I thought, well, since he wasn't coming along, I guess I'm going to go ahead and go to Europe on my own. So before I went, I was like a few months before my trip. And I had shared with a lady at my home group that I was going to England and Scotland by myself. And she goes, you're not going with a tour group? And I go, no. And I go, I'm just going to do it a day at a time. I had a train and a car pass. Easy does it. Every day, just find out where I want to go and get on one of those modes of transportation. And she said, there's pickpockets over there, Deb. And I swear to God, I was not afraid to travel to Europe alone until then. And then all of a sudden I'm like afraid, you know? And so God just takes care of us, because then this older gentleman showed up at my Monday book study, and Brian was from Bristol, England. And he was like 30 years older than me. And we became pen pals. And I wrote and I told him that I was afraid about traveling alone. I didn't tell him why. And so he wrote me back. He said, Deb, God lives this side of the pond. And he said, if you would like, I would love to take you to dinner and a meeting on your third day in London. And would you speak at my home group in Bristol on your last night? And I just cried when I got that letter, because I had AA commitments in a place I'd never been. And I was all shored up. I'd already got the international directory and so I could find AA meetings or contacts anyway in the towns I was going to go. And so I got to London the first night, and I just was wound up like an 8-day clock. And I thought, I'm going to meeting tonight. So I took a taxi cab over there. I got there early. That's what you taught me to do. And if I was going to feel a part of, I needed to go early and help out. And so I love tea anyway. And so I got there, and these women were making these massive pots of tea in the kitchen, and they let me help them. And so I was doing that, and we were just chatting it up. And then all of a sudden it was time for the meeting, and I had a place in this pew. And so I went back into the middle of this row, and I sat. And all of a sudden the tea lady came to the end of the aisle, and she goes, Deb, Deb, come here, come here. And I'm like, excuse me, pardon me. And I snuck back out in the aisle, and she goes, mind you, all of and next to you is a pickpocket. And I'm like, oh my God, I've been in this town about 7 hours. As I should have known I'd find him in AA. But anyway, and so I went back and took my seat, and I'm not kidding you, I welled up with tears, not out of fear, but out of the love of God and Alcoholics Anonymous, that God was looking out for me. And he worked through that lady so that I knew I was being taken care of. And when I looked at that gentleman, I got to shake his hand. and welcome him to Alcoholics Anonymous, because clearly he was a homeless man. And I knew I was no different than him. I sat through that meeting and I was like, I'm a thief from stealing from the ice cream place that I worked in when I was a teenager. And he's a pickpocket. There's no difference. Tomato, tomato. You know what I mean? And that if he stayed sober, if he stayed in this program, he wouldn't be a thief anymore either. And it's like, I just love what Alcoholics Anonymous does for us. It's like, it doesn't matter if you're famous or you're homeless. You have the same advantage here. Doesn't matter if you have money or not. The 12 steps are here. You don't even have to put a penny in the basket, though I need you to. Being self-supporting, we do that. But anyway, I just love that about this program. You know, everybody has a chance here, an equal chance. It's just, you're going to get in out of it what you put into it. And so I came back from that trip and I just had a great time. And Brian and I were pen pals for many, many years. I went to two international conventions and got to meet up and that kind of stuff. And he passed away a few years ago. But a couple of years later, I decided to go to Germany. I had lived there when I was a kid. I went to kindergarten and first grade in Newburgh. And so I became pen pals with a gal kindergarten with, and we still are to this day. In fact, I was supposed to be going to Europe for 3.5 weeks in September this year, and it didn't work out because everything got canceled. But I hope to go in 2 years. But we're still in touch after all of these years. And so it was really neat. So I went there and I got to see her and go tool around. I think it was like my third time I got in a car accident. And before I left, I had passed out twice on the bathroom floor. And I went to the doctor and I didn't know what was wrong. And he did blood tests and he said, Deb, you're seriously anemic. Be careful on this trip. And I was. And but then I got in that car accident and nothing got broke or anything except the car anyway. And so then I went, it's wonky driving on the other side, but anyway, that was in Germany. You do drive on the same side. You just drive really fast anyway. And so I went and they tested me again and they said, you're not anemic anymore, but we see that you have a rare autoimmune blood disease where your body's attacking itself. And for 11 years, I was on and off high doses of steroids and whacked out of my mind. And those were some tough years for me. You know, I was, I only got like 2 to 5 hours sleep a night and still working full time and going to meetings at night. And it was just, it was like it cut me off from my conscious contact with God. And I meditated 20 minutes every day. I never missed a day during that time. I was taught by I took a private transcendental meditation class to enhance my 11th step. And this lady was from Germany. And she goes, I said, I don't know if I can get this, Elizabeth, because my head is so busy. She goes, oh, that's just your ego. She goes, I tell my ego, I love you very much. And I'll give you my undivided attention in 20 minutes. And so she's taught me to just sit down, put your butt in a chair and try it anyway. Doesn't matter where your thoughts go, just make the effort. I did that. But, you know, she's 20 minutes of meditation equaled 2 hours of sleep. And so that helped me during those times and not being able to sleep. And I was jacked up on steroids and wanted to stab myself with steak. I'm up alphabetizing my spices at 2 a.m. angry tweaker. But anyway, you know what? I look back and I made it through that. I never wavered on my Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to my meetings. I had to give up commitments. Dr. Paul sponsored me for a few years during that time. He himself, my sponsor, he goes, you are going to call me every week. And he had me give up all my speaking commitments, local and out of town. And my platelets started to go back up and he cared about me. And I think it was his Al-Anon background too. He got me going to Al-Anon and I did all my steps in that program. And I learned that that I wasn't going to get drunk if I had to cut back a little bit because it was to take care of my health. It wasn't because I didn't think that I needed to do service anymore or I was too well for those kind of commitments or anything else, but I did have to cut back a little bit and I made it through those times. They took my spleen out and then 5 years later, I grew another one, go figure. And they took that out and been well ever since then. And I thank God for that. Another thing that he brought me through, and, you know, I've been able to share with some of my friends. Kelly DeWitt was one of my good golfing friends. He was going through a divorce and found out he had cancer at the same time. And Kelly and Phil and I were the three musketeers, and we used to golf every weekend together for almost 2 years. We go to Warner Springs and go stay in the little casitas out there and play, you know, both days. And they would be in an adjoining room. Kelly was up on steroids because of his cancer treatment. And it was like, I got to talk to him and say, it's not your program, Kelly, it's the medication. And I got to share my experience in another area of my life, you know, to make somebody else think it's not that you're not working your program, it's what the medicine does to you. And so I miss him. You know, I've had some great friends in this program and taught me so much, you know, and I've been able to sponsor a lot of neat people, women, and taking them through the book and watching the lights come on. And I've got a couple of girls right now that are so on fire for AA. And it's just, you know, the big book says it's a bright spot of our lives to watch people recover and to see them turn around and help others. And Carl gets to see that every day in his work, you know, but it's like, it is a great joy. And, you know, if you're new here or you've been here a little bit or you're coming back, welcome home. Stay here and give this everything you've got, because you deserve the good life you get with you putting in as much as you can into this program, and you'll have a beautiful life. I just want to end with a story about my grandpa, because I love doing that. But I got to speak at the South Bay Roundup, and it's this awesome conference in Torrance. And I think it's 20 years now. And when I was speaking, Roger Daniels was leading the meeting. And he and Annie had moved. They got sober in Torrance, so they came back every year for that conference. And then they moved to New Mexico. But he was leading the meeting next to me. And I said, I shared what I did here tonight about my grandpa getting sober in 1947 in Michigan. And he died before I got sober. And so he said, I want this weekend about your grandpa. My uncle got sober in Michigan. Maybe they knew each other. And I'm thinking, the mitten's big, pal. I'm sure they didn't know each other. Michigan's a big state. But anyway, I thought that. I didn't say it. And so he said, what town was your grandpa from? And I said, it was this little tiny town called Jackson, Michigan, outside of Jackson, called Vandercook Lake. And he goes, that's where my uncle was from. He lived in Vandercook Lake. And I'm like, oh, my God. And my grandma was still alive then. She passed away when she was 95 years old. And he goes, call your grandma and ask her if she remembers my uncle. And I said, well, what's his name? And he said, it was Roy Wine. I'm like, I love that name. How many drink wines are in AA? But anyway, and so I called my grandma and I asked her if she remembered him. And she said, she didn't miss a beat. 95. She goes, well, yeah, Deb. She goes, when grandpa's drinking got so bad that I had to throw him out of the house, she said, Roy Drinkwine was the man who carried the AA message to your grandpa. And it's like, oh my God, I love you, grandma. Bye. And then I called Roger and Annie and I said, we're related. And we were all crying on the phone, and we got to go to the International in Toronto together. Annie couldn't make it, but Roger and I did. And we got to hear Mel B speak at a local meeting. And Mel wrote a lot of books about Alcoholics Anonymous. He lived in Toledo, and he was best friends with Roy Drinkwine, and he worked at a factory with my other grandpa. And it's just this small world, and how we end up right where we're supposed to be when we say yes to Alcoholics Anonymous. And Carl, thank you for being my friend. Thank you for allowing me to share at your meeting, and God bless all of you. Thanks.